This is not theoretical. We spend our time in library many, many an hour. You ask us, you ask Udo, you ask any of us who struggle here, any of us at all, whether it's Dr. Rickmacher in Holland or whether it's Ryan in England or Hervey in the University of Milan, you spend endless hours, hours, hours of men who will try something at this point in their argumentation, and you must not let them. And that is simply the fact that almost all men who hold the theory that there are no answers and that everything is unrelated and meaningless are very selective in their arguments. So what you find is, I have never met anybody who holds this position. Maybe someone lives in the world, I haven't found him yet. And that is, a man who holds this position will always argue with you, most rationally, and insist that Christianity is nonsense on the basis of facts and rationality. And then suddenly when you catch him in the corner, he begins to argue irrationality. Now when you see this, you must understand you're talking to people, therefore, who are using a very selective argument. And this doing so, it destroys the whole in its value as a total philosophic position. You find very, very quickly they slipped over into this area. And in such a case, therefore, you find that it is a suspect philosophy. Because philosophy is supposed to explain the totality of things. We'll look into a very special use of this selective use of irrationality when we come to liberal theology and the problem of morals. We'll come to that later. Thus we find that the first class of answer, irrationalism, really is no answer. Theoretically it can be held, but no one lives with it in regard to either the external world or in the categories of their thought or the categories of their discussion. And that's an important thing to say. You must understand, modern man, if you think of Chomsky's basic grammar, if you think of Levi Strauss's wrestling with the natives of Africa today, modern man is beginning to realize that somehow or other, and I'm going to come to it later in epistemology, again in a different field, men are beginning to realize that somehow or other there are categories of the mind, in other words, form in the head as well as form in the external world. Now as we come to this place, therefore, you must see that the dilemma of holding this total irrationality is that it neither fits the form, the categories of the external world, you cannot go out through the solid world, nor does it fit the categories of the mind. Let me say in parenthesis here, if you think I'm passing by things too quickly, and I do have this criticism at times, and tonight it surely is, but having said this, if you think it's also true in the book, you must understand that behind every point in the book, there are hundreds and hundreds of hours of discussion and many things on tape in the tape library. So if you will, for example, run through any of our books, what you'll find is that over and over and over again, if you thumb through the index of our book and then you look at the tape library, you'll find a discussion of maybe 50 hours, 40 hours, 30 hours dealing with one or two lines in the book. So we haven't passed this by easily. And that's true about tonight, too. If you're interested in reading about Chomsky and Levi Strauss, please look at my tape, listen to my tape on evolution and chance, in the second lecture, if you'd be so kind. Now, let us notice, therefore, that if you really held this position consistently, a conversation would come to an end, and the only noises you can make would be blah, blah, blah. Because it is not a trick when we say that if there's only randomness in the world, then the first thing that will go will be syntax and the normal use of language. And this is one place where the theater of the absurd people can show us something, in not their answer, but again the definition of the problem. In other words, all discussion, all thought within our own head would really come to an end on any basis of normal grammar and the normal language, if indeed we held this position consistently. Consequently, that being so, we insist again that theoretically this can be held, that there are no answers, but it is always selective, with pockets of order brought in somehow along the line. Thus this class of answer is not an answer. The theater of the absurd is perhaps the clearest illustration. If you read carefully Essling on the theater of the absurd, I have a whole tape on the theater of the absurd again in Essling's work. But if you read Essling's little book on the theater of the absurd, the paperback's worth reading, though it's a little old now. Theater of the absurd is not quite as important now as it was then, perhaps, but it's still important because we have it in other forms. So if you watch over the theater of the absurd, even with a man like Essling presenting it, what you quickly find is that even the law all the time, that the theory of the absurd is saying we must evaluate language and evaluate syntax in order to insist that there is no communication. At the same time, the whole point of the thing is a communication that there is no communication. And this is, really, I never make tricks with my language. Please, if you're taking notes, take them like mad at these points. The second class of answers. Now, I've disposed of class number one. Class number one, therefore, is simply the answer. Simply the answer, there is no answer. Everything is chaotic. Everything is irrational. Everything is random. The second class of answer. The second class of answer in metaphysics, morals, and epistemology is that there can be rationally and logically considered answers. There are answers that can be rationally and logically considered. See, it's the reverse of class number one. There can be communication in my head to myself and discussion, that is communication with others. Because things can be discussed reasonably on the basis of reasonable terms and reasonable language. Now, at this particular place, we switch over now and we stop the general discussion and we move into the basic philosophic problems and metaphysics and being, existence, and then, the Lord willing, in the next lecture, man is his dilemma, and then finally, epistemology. Like this. So now, metaphysics, being, existence. In the area of the second class of answer, there are reasonable answers that can be thought of and discussed. Being, existence. Basic philosophic question, answer number one. Three basic answers, which are open to rational consideration. Again, if you'd be so kind, some of you get me this. When you go ahead and consider these, please, if you have a red pencil again, underline basic in red. Make it that plain. Three basic answers which are open to rational consideration in the area of metaphysics. The first answer is everything that now exists, everywhere, anywhere, has come out of absolutely nothing. Everything that ever exists has come out of absolutely nothing. Now, at this particular place, I suggest to you the kind of a formula that I always use, especially if you're discussing with your professor, the kind of formula I always use when I'm discussing in some university circle. And that is always say, when you're talking about nothing, you must understand that, that's Greek alpha, incidentally. But you have here, so you come here, what in a formula, no matter what kind of formula you're going to spring here as to nothingness, what are we talking about that would have to be negated if you were going to say there's absolutely nothing that everything come out of, you see? And you have various factors here. A equals zip, 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 and I'll give them to you now. Everything, if you're going to negate everything, you have to negate mass, energy, motion, and personality. Mass, energy, motion, and personality. You must negate these. That is A in my formula, always in discussion. At this particular point. Thank you so much. That is A in my formula at this place. It means there's no mass, no energy, no motion, no personality. It's what I call in my discussion always nothing, nothing. Nothing, nothing. Just like true truth, you can feel this parallel here. And you've got to do this because words have been so devaluated that nobody listens to anything anymore unless you do something that really says I'm talking about nothing. So now, how are you going to describe nothing, nothing? Well, I describe nothing, nothing like this. Draw a circle. I won't draw it here because I've messed up this blackboard so it wouldn't show any longer my prop what I want. But supposing instead of that I had a perfectly new, lovely, the black or green blackboard. And I had this. So what I would have in this situation then is a perfectly green or black blackboard. And I drew a big circle, and because it was brand new, and the fellow who had painted his job very well, like this, there's no marks, no flaws, and what you'd have is a completely uniform blackness. And then in the midst of that uniform blackness, we have a circle, you see? And in that circle, there is absolutely nothing. And metaphysically understood, there's nothing outside of the circle that isn't in the circle. So everything there is in the circle, but there isn't anything in the circle. And then you take the rubber and you rub it out. And the circle's gone. That's nothing, nothing. And this is not a joke. Because you'll get tricked in every conversation in the world with anybody who tries to do this by talking about nothing, and they never mean nothing, nothing. They always mean nothing, something. And they'll sneak in with you a little bit of energy, a little bit of that, a little bit of emotion, or a little bit of personality. And you must never let them. You must say, naughty, naughty. What you've done is sneak in something to give an answer when you said the answer is nothing. You must be careful at this point. Now we get on, so we're talking about nothing, nothing. Now I've heard this discussed as a theoretical possibility, but I have never heard it argued. I have never heard it argued as long as you talk really hold people to nothing, nothing. And the simple reason that this position is never argued, this basic philosophic answer in the area of being, existence, is never argued, I'm convinced, is simply because it's totally unthinkable. It's totally unthinkable. It is totally unthinkable that everything that we can see, the stars, the lot, man, and everything, has come out of nothing, nothing. That's impossible to think about. It's an impossible thought. Somebody might respond as a prove it isn't so, and I would say it's pretty hard to prove it isn't so when nobody can think about it. Now then, and if you think, I'm not being tricksy here, I'm really not. I'd be willing to sit down and talk to an hour to any of you, and I wouldn't really, because it'd be a waste of somebody else's life here at this conference. But come to La Brie and somebody will talk to you for an hour if you want to try to argue about nothing, nothing, about this. As a theoretical possibility, even though it's unthinkable. That moves it back really into a different area, I would suggest. It would move it back into class number one, the answer that is irrational and random. So I think this is all right. If you want to discuss it with some others, you can, of course. Now, point number two, the second basic philosophic question. The second basic philosophic question in the area of metaphysics, of existence, is that all that there is had an impersonal beginning. All that there is had an impersonal beginning. No personality. Now, you must also be careful here, and that is, if a man chooses an absolutely impersonal beginning, you must not let him have a little personality either, if you know what I mean. So now here is the second class of answer in the area of metaphysics, an absolutely impersonal beginning. You can begin with mass, energy, or motion. This makes no basic philosophic difference. It still must be labeled at this particular place. It must be labeled as impersonal. And now, if you're making a formula, may I suggest B as your formula. A is either mass, energy, personality, or mass, energy, motion, or personality. B has now become that which is impersonal of A, namely, mass, energy, or motion. And you must be careful at this point, because beginning with energy doesn't give any more of a real answer than beginning with mass. Men haven't learned that yet, and you find all kinds of strange arguments, but it doesn't stand up to discussion. For example, Salvador Dali says this is the time when he moved from his surrealism, he says it for himself, when he moved from his surrealism into his new mystical period. And if you want to read this, you can find it. It was in a Playboy magazine of many years ago. Curiously enough, some of the most personal and clearest interviews of some of these men are found in Playboy. I don't know why, but that's the way it goes. Now then, as you come to this, Salvador Dali tries to make a jump from his surrealism, and surrealism could be defined as Dada plus Freud. All right, but Dada, be careful, I'm talking about Dada philosophy as well as art and so on. Dada, you know, came from Zurich at, what was the name of it? Café Voltaire, wasn't it? Yeah, Café Voltaire, Dada was born. Dada plus Freud, and look in Dr. Ruckmacher's book and mine if you want to pursue this point at this point. So you come to this place that you have, surrealism says, there's nothing there, really, not in the sense of not metaphysically, but it's really absurdity. Make your poems merely by chance, you see. And yet at the same time, you add Freud, So you have a soul, you have a subconscious with a nothingness. And that Salvador Dali sort of draws, isn't it, you know? And then suddenly he had a certain came to a certain period, and I would suggest you have to bring together what I point out in the God who is there concerning Salvador Dali and the basket of bread and the crucifixion of St. John and the cross, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with the understanding from Playboy, again, which does not contradict any of this, it fits together, Salvador Dali has said it both things, and that is suddenly he was given a mystical religious hope, not in any sense of meaningful religion or anybody being there, simply by thinking he could have a better answer by reducing everything to energy than matter, but it won't stand up. So what you've come to now is the fact that beginning with energy doesn't really give any more answer than beginning with mass. If you really are holding to be with a careful definition, namely, you're beginning totally with an impersonal. Now, if you're dealing in the areas of science, this in the area of science is reductionism. Reductionism. In science and in philosophy, but especially in science, reductionism is that you can explain everything there is now from the stars to man. And this is all finally to be understood by reducing everything to its original impersonal factor or factors. That's reductionism. Some of you, I would advise you, if you're working the areas of science, get this terrific book, Beyond Reductionism. It's not written from a Christian viewpoint at all, but it shows the death of the second stage of Darwinism. Now, four. The great problem with beginning with the impersonal is what then does the particulars mean? Now, particulars means the individual parts of the whole. A drop of water is a particular, and a man is a particular. In other words, I'm using philosophic terms here rather than scientific. Anything individually is a particular, using this terminology. It's proper terminology. Everybody uses it in philosophy, almost everybody. Now, the dilemma with beginning with the impersonal is this, and that is, if you begin with the personal, how do any of these particulars have any meanings, any significance, including man? I'm not going to discuss this, but you just listen and we can discuss it some other time. But write it down and think about it. How do the particulars have any meaning? How do the particulars have any meaning, whether it's man or whether it's a drop of water, any significance, if you begin with an absolute impersonal? Think of Sartre's words about impersonal, about reference points. Now, beginning with the impersonal everything, that's a term of my own. Please write it down so you understand my term. Well, it has to be in the glossary when the book is out. Beginning with the impersonal everything, including man. In other words, if you begin with an impersonal everything, then everything including man must be explained by the impersonal plus time plus chance. And the reason, if you begin with an impersonal, you must explain everything by the impersonal plus time plus chance, because there isn't anything else. And no one has ever shown it, either in terms of philosophy or in terms of the East or the terms of the West, in terms of the ancient or the terms of the modern, in terms of science or the terms of metaphysics, nobody has ever demonstrated, either in theory or in the laboratory in any way, and that is how, if you only have time and chance, beginning with an impersonal, that you can have the needed complexity of the present universe, let alone the personal aspects of man. And here I would suggest you're looking up my work with Murray Eden. Murray Eden, professor of statistics at MIT. In other words, how in the world, if you don't have any other element except time plus chance, how is the impersonal, and that's all you have with no personality, how are you going to go on and get plus time plus chance? How in such a situation is it going to come up to a situation where there's really any meaning in the lot at all? Now, no one has demonstrated how this can be so. And I would just say, in Murray Eden's experiments, you must understand the evolutionary biologist is under horrible attack today from his own peers in the thinking world. And there's a lot of people pitted against the present theories of evolution. And no one is pitted against the present theories of evolution more than the man in statistics since he has been given the huge computer. Nobody. And I don't mean Christians. Christians haven't learned to play this game yet, unhappily. But what you must find is, and I'll just quote Murray Eden very, very quickly. You can look him up. There's a girl here who's just listened to the tape, so she can tell you what edition's in. I always forget.
It's in Chemistry and Engineering magazine of a couple of years ago, giving very, very carefully the experiments of Mary Eden. And Mary Eden would weigh his experiments, his conclusions, something like this, or at least this is the best way to do it as far as Chemistry magazine is concerned, and that is you run through something like this, and that is given the high-speed computers at MIT and giving any amount of time that's acceptable to anybody's thought, up to 8 billion years, then on the basis of statistics that you can feed through the computer, is there any possibility of pure time plus pure chance bringing the present complexity in the external world? That's a nice question, isn't it? It really is. It excites me. And when you come ahead and Murray Eden says that given the present complexity of the external world, and never mind personality, whatever you're going to do with that, regardless of what you're going to do with this, given the present complexity of the external world, on the basis of 8 billion years and on the basis of absolute chance plus only time, the possibility of the present complexity as coming forth by chance and time in 8 billion years is absolute zero. Don't you like that? I do. And I'm sure he's right. And you might, some of you have worked in computers for a long while. I keep asking people, tell me how he must program this thing. And I had a man working in Huntsville on the space program said, sure. Matter of fact, it was in Dr. Barnes' home the last time I was here. I'll give you the name of the program. It's the Monte Carlo program. You can write that down, too, if you're computer people. So now, what we have is that I'm giving the dilemma of the impersonal. Now then, what you find at this point is often this is called pantheism. Now, so you'll know what I'm going to do. What time do you have? I have about 5 minutes to 10, right? All right, less than 2 hours. Have courage. What I'm going to do, I'm going to go to a certain point. I'm going to ask nobody to leave unless you faint. And when I come to the next stage, and that is point number 3, the opposite answer to the impersonal, I'll give anybody who wants to get out of this place 5 minutes. But not 6. I'm not kidding. Don't spoil it for everybody else if you're tired. And you could clear it out in 5 minutes if I yell fire. So you could clear it out in 5 minutes if I say fire. And so let's come to this. And please don't stand in the hall out there and disturb and bug everybody else, because people have to think about it. It doesn't come like apples on trees. So please, if you're going to leave, find another place to go and then talk all night if you want. But in about 5 or 6 minutes now, I'm going to say fire. And in 5 minutes, we want to clear the hall, except for people who still want to keep on for another, say, half hour. All right? Is that fair? But don't leave till I say fire now. All right. Now, what you must understand, there's certain ways in which you can speak of the impersonal beginning as pantheism. The word pantheism. But you must understand that pantheism is a semantic solution. In the God Who Is There, read my long, rather lengthy discussion on the present mysticism's always being semantic solutions. The word solutions. They're the solutions that turn upon connotation of the word and have nothing to do with the defined use of words, usually. Now what you find then, this should really be called pan-everythingism. Now please follow along. And I urge you with all my heart, if you've been hung up on anything from Tillich's pantheism to hippie pantheism to scientism's pan-everythingism, to really understand that you must be careful for your own thinking and then in discussion to realize that the word pantheism, if clearly defined, really becomes a semantic trick. So for yourself first and then for discussion, I urge you with all my heart, please, please, understand that pantheism always, if it is really the real meaning of pantheism, which always means that the ultimate reality has no place for final personality. That's the real definition of pantheism. In the East and the West, among the old and the past, the old and the new, in carefully defined terms. It is never pantheism, it is pan-everythingism. And just in a parenthesis, if you discuss in your university, try what I've done for many years now, and I've never seen it to fail, to go badly, so you must do it with love, or it turns out to be a gimmick, and then you may win the argument, but you'll never see people go to heaven.
merely by winning arguments. And that is simply the fact that when the fellow comes up and he speaks of pantheism, you must always be careful. Every time you speak of the same thing he has called pantheism, you must always use the term pan-everything-ism. And in about a half hour, if you do it with real love and prayer, and you love this guy, and he knows you're loving him, and you're not just booby-trapping him and mouse-trapping him, if really you do this and he knows that, in about a half hour, you'll find the conversation almost always will shift. Because pan-everythingism is really a better word for his own definition of the symbol pan-everything, or pantheism. So use it in discussion as well as comprehension. Pan-everythingism is more accurate. The word pantheism is a linguistic trick. Now, this is true whether it is Eastern pantheism, modern liberal theology pantheism, either Roman Catholic or Protestant. You must understand, almost all modern theology, either progressive Roman Catholic or liberal theology, following, say, Karl Barth, almost all of this is really has pantheistic elements. Tillich is the clearest case. But you can find the same thing, you go to the same thing in Roman Catholic progressive thinking, too, if you go far enough with some of these men. Or, not only liberal Western theological pantheism, Protestant or Roman Catholic, but also modern scientific pan-everythingism, which reduces everything to the impersonal energy particle. Because you must understand, in reality, by carefully defined terms, there's no real difference between the Hindu final concept of reality and the modern scientist who reduces everything in his reductionism to final energy particles. Now, I'm not saying the East believes in energy particles, I'm saying, philosophically, you end with a total impersonal, in either case. Now then, pan-everythingism gives an answer for the needed unity. Be careful now if you're going to discuss to understand its strong points as well as its weak. Pan-everythingism gives an answer for the needed unity. But pan-everythingism gives nothing for the needed diversity. Or to say it another way, those of you who have been playing around with Hinduism and so on, if you take the original sound of Om, or however you wish to pronounce it, the first, the great cosmic sound, putting this into Eastern terms, or hippie terms at this point, I'm using hippie as a wide word here rather than a narrow one, which is maybe unfair, but forgive me then, because you know I love anybody, I'm not talking about this. I'm trying to find words so everybody understands, that's all. But whether you're dealing with Eastern Hindu pan-everythingism or the hippie pan-everythingism, eventually you often are dealing with the word as the first cosmic sound. But you must understand that really logically reasonably on the basis of pan-everythingism, the word should only have been one note with not only no variations but no timbre. None at all. There is no reason for the giving, for the existence, not the meaning of meaning in particular, but there is absolutely, absolutely no reason to explain the existence of a diversity on the basis of pan-everythingism. I'm here talking about unity and diversity, which is one of the great basic philosophic questions. Beginning with the impersonal, there is no meaning or significance to diversity. Beginning with impersonal, there is no final meaning to the meaning or significance to diversity. So you have a very nice answer for one half of the problem, namely, that is unity, but you have no answer for diversity. Now, secondly, it gives an answer for form, but it has no meaning for freedom. And that's the second great big question, of course. Now then, usually at this point, it's an attempt is made to answer one or either of these objections on the basis of the introduction of cycles, such as the waves cast up out of the sea to fall back into the sea and disappear. The difficulty with this is no one can explain why the particular should be there or the waves. And it's certainly, even if you just accept this and shrug your shoulders, though that's hard to do if you're a thinking man, in this particular case, on the other hand, if you do this, it would still not give any solution as to any meaning to the waves. So now I've said two big objections. First of all, I've given many objections, but in this couplet here, first of all, it gives an answer to unity, but none to diversity. Second, it gives a meaning to form, but none to freedom. And then finally, and then we're done, and I'll say fire, and that is this, and that is that morals can have no possible meaning as morals under pan-everythingism. Now, I've moved over into day after tomorrow's lecture, whenever it is, and morals, but I have to bring it in here to make this complete. And that is, morals can have no meaning as morals, for everything in pan-everythingism is finally equal. So you end always in the area of morals in a pan-everythingism with only the word morals and never with morals. In other words, beginning with the impersonal, you do not have answers regarding existence. It's a big statement, but it's backed up by 40 years of hard work as anybody's ever put into these things, I think. So now that's the end of my study of the second basic philosophic question and the second basic answer to the philosophic question of metaphysics, namely beginning with the impersonal. I'm going to turn now to the personal answer, beginning with the impersonal. Now please, 5 minutes and not seven, because you'll hurt the other people who want to stay. So now you have 5 minutes to get out of the hall and fire. No questions. I just want to lay down some ground rules, the same as we have in Waymo, and that is, Labrie, feel free to say, please don't ask questions, usually on lecture night, for the simple reason the man is tired, sometimes it isn't fair, and we feel free to do that because you know most of Labrie is discussion rather than lecture. So it's fair enough. I think it's fair game, of course. I think we get better lectures, and at the same time, we get better discussion, usually. All right, personal. Number three. It's been called to my attention I may have messed up the numbers. Completely conceivable on that one. We're talking then, let's quickly define it, we're talking in the area of metaphysics, being, existence. We have definitely removed certain classes of answers. We then come to one class of answer. We now have come to the class of answer of those things that can be described and with some accuracy, certainly, and discussed in your own head and with others. Point number one, everything has come out of an absolute nothing. Point number two, you begin with an impersonal, no matter what you call it. Point number three, and that is you begin with a personal beginning. Are we all right now? I'm awfully sorry if I messed you up. All right, now a personal beginning. Now, let me say this with some care, and that is that I believe with the third answer of beginning with the impersonal that we have exhausted the basic philosophic answers in the area of metaphysics. Please remember, we could discuss for hours and hours and hours, and men have discussed for lifetimes, literally lifetimes, detail heaped upon detail under any of these headings. Please understand this is not simplistic. In other words, I know there are all kinds of differences in Hinduism. I know there are all kinds of differences in Buddhism. I know there's a difference between Buddhism and Hinduism. I know Zen is different than something else. I understand, again, that the impersonalism of the energy particle can be discussed for years and years and years and years in these questions. I understand all this. But when you get done, you can still make an outline of the basic considerations. That's all I'm doing. But when we come to this, I would insist that we have come to the final thing of the basic philosophic question. I have a feeling I've left something out. If I have, I'll feel free to tell you another time. I have a little bell ringing back in my mind somewhere. Somewhere I've dealt with dualism. I can't find it. We'll skip it for the moment. I'll find it. But it doesn't matter anyway. We can deal with that when I find in my notes another time. It really doesn't matter at this point. So now we're beginning with a personal. If instead of beginning with nothing, and instead of beginning with the impersonal, you begin with a personal, what happens? Remember, our basic thesis is the philosophic necessity in the area of metaphysics, for he is there and he's not silent. That's what we're moving towards. This is what our real discussion is dealing with. So now as we begin with the personal, we must understand that in this, therefore, what you said is that the personal, that everything that is, begins with a personal. Or you can say that which is personal begins everything else. So maybe if you're making formulas now, you would have to put C. A equals time plus chance plus motion plus personality. B equals three of these. C equals the last. You see where we're going. Somebody can work out a very nice scientific formula here when we're done. That which is personal begins everything else.
In this case, notice my definition, or you'll never get anywhere with anybody, including yourself after an hour's thought. I'm not talking about French personalism here, for those of you who are philosophers. I'm not talking about French personalism. I'm not saying everything is personal. I think you can argue and say, if everything is personal, then nothing is personal. It's under the, I think eventually, impersonalism will lead in a big circle back to, I mean, personalism will lead in a big circle back to the impersonal beginning, unless you have something different in the universe that's really personal against everything being personal, if you're using French impersonalism. But what we're talking about now is that not that everything is personal, and this is really a very important distinction, it's not that everything is equally personal, but there is that which is personal, which begins everything else. Those of you especially who have listened to my lectures on the basic philosophic questions, please put down this definition, because I've never clearly defined it in the basic philosophic question, and I'm sorry. But I gave it many years ago when I hadn't finished thinking about it. So now when I talk about everything beginning with a personal, I'm talking about there is that which is personal, which begins everything else. Now this, in this case, man as personal does have meaning. Now listen, notice where we're going. I'm going to make some statements and then we'll substantiate them. I think it's perfectly safe to make them. And that is, in this case, that is, if everything there is began with that which is personal, in this case, man is personal, does have meaning, for the origin of all is personal, and therefore the personal now has meaning. What am I saying? I'm saying a very simple thing, and yet one that you must get clear in your thinking, and it is profound as well as simple. And that is the fact that if you begin with that which is impersonal, you haven't any way to show where the personal comes from. But if you begin with that which is personal and it begins everything else, then you can understand that the origin of everything is personal, and therefore the personal now is not surprising. Man and his aspirations are not meaningless, because man's aspiration of the reality of personality are in line with what originally and intrinsically was. I hope you can, you know, these are on tape. So take notes like mad, I would urge you, and then listen to the tapes and make sure your notes sound right. But you must understand, here is a basic discussion when you get down into the last discussion of all intellectual thought in philosophy, and you get into the discussion of all really careful thought in religion, including Christianity. And it falls at this place. It's always in the area of beginnings. You cannot, when we move over in epistemology, what I'll try to demonstrate, and I think it can be surely clearly shown from the modern movies, is the factor that if you don't have the proper beginnings, you'll never come up with the right categories or any meaning. So what, or you don't know how you know unless the beginnings are right. So the beginnings determine everything. And I'll just say in a parenthesis, that's why you must never, never, never give away Genesis 1 to 12. Never in a million years. Give away Genesis 1 to 12 and say this is not propositional, and you'll never be able to defend Christianity in a way that'll make any sense to a reasonable man. Utterly impossible. Because beginnings determine categories and meanings. As simple as this. Now what you have here is, therefore, that immediately we have the opposite from that which we had as a great cry of horror if we had sensitive feelings for other men as well as ourselves and our children. On the side of the impersonal. On the side of the impersonal, there's no explanation of the personal. On the side of the, you begin with the personal, and the personal does something, the personal makes everything else. In this case, therefore, you have the opposite thing, obviously. And that is, the man's aspirations are not meaningless, because it's in line with what not only now is, but that which originally was and always has been. Namely, that the basic, eternal, the basic thing that is there, is the factor that man and his aspirations are not alienated from what has always been. Now somebody's going to say, but why start here? Why do you dare say, start with this, and it's a theoretical question of necessity, any more than just saying that nothing was there? But you can't, and I will quote you, start again. No man has the luxury, you see, no man has the luxury of not explaining what's here. The basic philosophic question is that something's there.
So what you can't do is to slip into nothing and make it something nothing, and then we're back in the other circle. So, but notice, I'm just protecting myself and protecting you here. Nobody has the luxury of not beginning with something. You understand what I'm saying? There's no basic philosophic or religious answer that begins with nothing. So therefore, you have to begin with something. And the only really final discussion, whether it's an impersonal beginning or a personal beginning, and there is no other discussion when you're down to the end of the discussion, believe me. So consequently, at this point now, therefore, with this solution, namely that you begin with a personal, which and then from that everything else comes, you not only have the answer, or a solution, for the existence of bare being, capital B, with personality which distinguishes man from non-man. So the funny part is suddenly the keys begin to turn. In other words, if you choose impersonality, you can't explain man's personality, but you can't explain the existence of bare being either. Yet, on the other, either bare being is bare being, or bare being specially is in its complexity. Remember Murray Eden. But suddenly, if you begin with a personal, the curious thing is that suddenly you not only have an explanation of why man can be different, but you have an explanation of the other thing, of how you can have being with form and not chaos. It's amazing, really, as you wander through this. Now, I would use the illustration I use in one of my books, and I forget which one. Maybe I forget. Some of you should know. And that is the illustration of the two valleys. And the simple fact is, if you come to the Alps, for example, what you will find if you come to the Alps is the factor that sometimes in the Alps you have a mountain springs a leak. Curious, but it happens. And you have a valley, and then you have a second valley with mountains in between. It can be 5 miles, it doesn't make any difference, in between the mountain with a valley and a valley. And there's water in this valley over here, and this is dry. And all of a sudden, for some reason, it doesn't take an earthquake at all, for some reason, for various reasons, suddenly this begins to fill up with water. And then you watch to see, you say, where is it coming from? And what you watch is, how high does it rise? And this is not theoretical, it actually happens in Switzerland occasionally. And then suddenly, what you find, men are watching, watch. So here, let's say this is this high over in valley number one, and in valley number two, the water begins to rise, to rise, to rise, to rise. Now, if water in valley number, valley over here, number two, rises to the same height as valley number one then is, everybody concludes there is a fine intellectual, rational, logical, reasonable possibility that the water in this valley came from that valley. It doesn't prove it necessarily at the beginning, but at least it's a thinkable thought. But if the water over here goes 10 meters higher than this water, nobody believes the water over here came from this valley. Nobody in a million years. Well, it's exactly like that. And that is, if you have personality, you can explain impersonality and its form, and you can explain personality. But if, on the other hand, you only have impersonality in valley one, you have no possibility of explaining where personality comes from at all. So please notice what we have now. But if we begin with less than personality, we must finally reduce personality to the impersonal. And this is true of modern scientific reductionism specifically. You can have the word personal, but the word personal will only be the impersonal plus complexity. So what you're left with is a semantic answer. If you begin with modern scientific reductionism or any form of impersonality, what you're left with is the word personality, but it's no longer personality, it's only the word personality, and what you're left with is the impersonal plus complexity. Can you really, then the question must arise, is that all personality is? And that is the impersonal plus complexity. And then you enter another discussion, of course. But nobody's shown us how. But once consider a personal beginning, we come to another choice, and that is God versus God. Once we begin with a personal beginning, we come to another choice, and that is God versus God. Why can't you choose gods instead of God? Wouldn't God, just as well as God, be a personal beginning? Well, there's a dilemma, and the difficulty is, with gods instead of God, is that limited gods are never big enough in men's thinking. And once you have gods rather than God, the gods are always limited. And that's just as true with the Greek and the Roman gods, and the great god Thor, let us say, the Anglo-Saxon and the Celtic gods, or the liberal theologian's gods, though he isn't sure it's there, actually, and I've chosen it by care, if you must understand, the Greek and the Roman gods, the great god store, any kind of gods that are limited, any kind of gods in which you have more than one god, they always turn out to be limited gods. It's got to be this way. Just obviously, if you think it through. In other words, we can now define what we need through in a philosophic necessity in the area of metaphysics in order to have an answer to being, its existence and its order, and man. And we now can define what we need. And you need two things and not one. What you need is, one, a personal infinite God. And what you need is a personal unity and diversity in God. A personal unity and diversity in God. What you need is a personal infinite God. What you need is a personal unity and diversity in God. That's points one and two. One, if you only have a person, if you only have, only, sorry, only a personal infinite God, remember my drawings now. I don't, for this group, surely I don't need to draw it once or more. And that is this thing, you know, which has been happily so much of a help to so many of us. And that is God, you remember, don't you? Personal, infinite, the chasm is here, the chasm is there. Remember? All right. So now what you come to is, you must understand, to have an adequate answer, you need a personal infinite God. And you must understand, I'll say now carefully, you must never get into a trap, and you're going to be, somebody will try to trap you. You mustn't let anybody say, is it personal, infinite, or infinite personal? You mustn't do it. What you always must say is personal, infinite, infinite personal. Can you understand that? And this is very, you'll lose every discussion in the world that has any real sense to it unless you're careful. And you must then ask the personal, well, personal, of course, will almost always say, if he's a modern man, can a personal thing be infinite, especially if he follows Kant. But if you're interested in why Kant is wrong at this place, and an infinite can be personal, I'll say it that way. And secondly, there's no way to make an absolute out of the finite to show an infinite can't be personal, and Kant really is wrong, I'll say talk to Udo. He's better than I with Kant. Now when you come to this, he might thank me for this tomorrow when you all, some expert on Kant calls on him. But nevertheless, Udo really understands German philosophy. After all, he was educated in the center of it all. So now what you have is, you need only an infinite personal God is big enough. And we must understand Plato here to understand why only an infinite God, is infinite personal God is great enough. So Plato argued better than anybody else has ever in the philosophic world of the necessity of absolute ideals or ideas. Absolute ideals or ideas. And it doesn't matter about terms here. Actually, ideals and ideas probably are sort of synonym here, but never mind. So he understood the absolute necessity of absolute ideas or ideals, not only in metaphysics and morals, but in epistemology. Incidentally, nobody ever knows the problems any better than these grand old fellows in the sense of intellectual, humanistic, rationalistic thought, who knew knew how they bumped their head on the wall long, long ago. They had no answers, but they were marvelous in defining problems. So what you have is Plato, Plotinus, the Neoplatonists, the High Renaissance, it's all the same. They understood the dilemma very beautifully. But you must understand that Plato's absolute ideas or ideals, Plato's gods were never big enough to meet his needs. And the way to understand this is the Greek gods and the faith. And you'll find this is treated at length in some of my books. And that is that the Greek gods never found a way to determine whether the faith stood back of God or the God stood back of the faith. Any of you have read Greek literature, I know I'm absolutely right on this one. And because they never could determine whether the faiths were bigger or the gods were bigger, at times the faiths controlled the gods and at times the gods controlled the faiths. And consequently, it is very obvious that their gods were big enough, not big enough for Plato's ideals, absolutes, and ideas. What will solve it? A personal infinite God. Point two, I'm not done with arguing this, I'm only defining still. Point two, we also need a personal unity and diversity in God. Can you please get the terms right? A personal unity and diversity in God.
A personal unity and diversity in God himself, if you see what I mean. That is, we do not need just an abstract concept of unity and diversity, but we need a personal unity and diversity, because as we have seen, we need a personal beginning. This is not a tautology. It really is not. What you're faced with at this particular place is that you need a unity and diversity, but it cannot be merely an abstract unity and diversity for the simple reason we've already seen you need a personal, and therefore they must be brought together somehow. I just say in passing, if you've never heard of the philosophic argument of unity and diversity, and you're studying philosophy, don't be surprised. They'll spring it on you somewhere when they've got you well hooked. And I'm being very, very sober with it. And the reason they do this is they do not tell you usually the basic philosophic questions until they have sold you through some kind of brainwashing, I mean this, to accept that which won't finally answer the basic philosophic question. Believe me. I don't know, of course, where they started. I don't know a single course. Maybe some of you can help me. I don't know, of course, where it starts right. And they talk with the basic philosophic questions and then start from the bottom and go to the top, or the top to the bottom, however you want to think of it, rather than the middle and working towards space. I've never seen one. If you have a philosophy, as the professor did, from a secular humanistic viewpoint, I would like to read his book. Really. I don't think he'd give him any answer, but at least he'd be an honest man. Now, we're talking about the philosophic necessity in the area of being of existence, that God is there and he is not silent. Remember, never forget what we're talking about. He is there and he is not silent. He is there and he is not silent. Now, there is no other sufficient philosophic answer in the area of metaphysics. There is no sufficient philosophic answer in the area of metaphysics. I'm sorry, but you'll be glad I make these clarifications the necessities of which ring in my own ear when you finally read the book, I'll say that. There's no other sufficient philosophic answer in the area of metaphysics other than the one I've outlined, and that is this personal beginning, this personal infinite beginning, this personal unity and diversity at the beginning of beginning with a capital B. The first beginning is a small b, the second b is a capital B. And I'm making a statement. There just simply is no other. And if you say it's proud, all right, but you show me one. And I'm not speaking merely out of one man's 40 years of work, but well over 2,000 years of Western philosophy, and however old the Eastern philosophies are as well. So I'm making a statement, or you can let me ask you a question, maybe you'll like it better, and that is there no other sufficient philosophy in the area of metaphysics other than the one I've outlined, and that is the personal beginning and the infinite personal beginning and the unity and diversity in the beginning of being. So you can ask it as a question or you can make it as a statement. I don't think it makes any difference. And I would just say very, very gently but very firmly, that's right, you've understood me. There is no other answer in the area of metaphysics, in the area of existence, in the kind of way I've defined it, unless you have this kind of a beginning. There really is not. Now then, you must understand there is only one philosophy or one religion that fills this need, and that is the Judaistic Christian God. And I say this quite without intellectual embarrassment. We can discuss many other things yet, but I would insist upon this completely. There is no other answer that fits this need, this philosophic necessity in the area of metaphysics, except the existence of the Judeo-Christian God. Remember, this is not an abstract concept, but I'm talking about his really being there. Now I'm back to God, the God who is there. Please don't think I'm discussing in an abstract, sort of scholastic, natural theology abstraction. It's not the case. I'm insisting on the factor here, however, that when we get done, that it is only the Judeo-Christian God, not as an abstract concept, but his really being there, is the only answer. Now, you must understand there is no word so meaningless as the word God. And I would insist on this one as well. You must understand any word is only a set of symbols, and that's all there is. And that is true with the word God as much as of any other word. So G, maybe you better write it like this. G, O, D. You have three symbols.
in a symbol system, and it's a symbol that stands there, G-O-D. What does it mean? And the answer is nothing. You must see this. It means absolutely nothing as it stands as a bare symbol in this area. You must understand with G-O-D, it's only a linguistic symbol. And this has no meaning because there is no symbol that has ever been given absolutely opposite answers so completely as this symbol. I do trust you're following me. I know those of you have been at Labrie and read my books, so have no problem here. You must understand you can't assume G-O-D means anything because it means in the pantheistic world, pan-everythingism world, God is impersonal. And over here you've got God in the Judaistic Christian system, God is personal. In the God, you can have God, or you can have God. I could talk for two, three days on this thing, of the meaninglessness of the word G-O-D as a symbol, as a linguistic symbol system until you put content into it. That's not only true of the word God, incidentally, I'll say in parenthesis, it's true of the word salvation, it's true of the word Jesus, it's true of any word, including Francis Schaeffer, that you can imagine. The new study of linguistics has value as a method, so as I've tried to show you in my working over the problems of epistemology today, it has no meaning as a philosopher. But it's a good method to comprehension in certain limited areas. Now what you have, therefore, is the word God has no meaning unless content is put into it. The word God as such is no answer to the philosophic problem of existence. Will you please write it down if you're taking any kind of notes at all, including if you only have your name at the head of the page? Incidentally, I'm intrigued. You know what I'm intrigued about? I'll tell you on the way past. You know who's taking the best notes? The guys who have spent hours and hours on the basic philosophic questions. Isn't that funny? Not in every case. Somebody's going to come up and kick me in the shins after. But having said this, I've watched you now for what? A couple hours? I'm intrigued. Who's taking notes and who's sitting here? I don't care if you just sit here. But I'm intrigued that the guys who are taking notes, and I bet you are going to turn out fine, are the ones who have really wrestled with my books in this area. I just say, if you only got your head at the top of the page, will you write this one? Of course, if you're depending on the tape, great. That's all I can say. But if you think you can memorize all this at one craft, really and truly, you can't. Can't be done. The word God as such is no answer to the philosophic problem of existence. The word God as such, is no answer to the philosophic problem of existence. In other words, God's words are meaningless. Ever hear any of that, any of your parents? Well, the kids are right. You're not right when you try to defend that God words have automatic meaning. God words answer nothing. And that's what the kids mean when they come and say a sentence like this to you. God words answer nothing. You have to have content in the God word. And boy, this means something in evangelism today, doesn't it? Whether we're black, yellow, white, whether we're old or young, it means something today. Whether we're using the new methods of the cinema, the drama, or whether we're using the old method of the radio, it means something today that to understand that the word God gives no answer to anything. You've got to put content into it. But notice that the Judaistic Christian content to the word God does meet the need of that which exists. Namely, the existence of the universe and its complexity, and man as man. Let me split this one with great care for you. And that is, the word God means nothing, but the content of that which is taught in the Old and the New Testament means a great deal in the explanation of A, in the area of metaphysics, of A, what is there, existence and its complexity, and B, man as man. Geo-Christian content to the word God is what we need. What is the Judeo-Christian content of what we need, of the word God, of what we need? It's very simple. It's that which is taught in the Old and the New Testament. That's what Judeo-Christian means. It's what that which is taught in the Old and the New Testament. That is the infinite personal God, and the God who is personal unity and diversity on the high order of Trinity. Do you want me to repeat it? The Judeo-Christian content of the word God, that which is given in the Old and the New Testament, that is the infinite personal God, and the God who is personal unity and diversity on the high order of Trinity. Inevitably, when I get down really with somebody who understands where the things to be discussed, suddenly I'm confronted time after time with a statement, can you as an educated man believe in the ontological Trinity? And my answer is, and I mean this with all my soul, tonight I would return to my agnosticism, but after all this study of 40 years, I believe to an absolute cynicism in the area of epistemology, eternal cynicism, if I didn't know of the Trinity. It is not that this is an intellectual embarrassment. If you know what you're talking about, you're talking about the Trinity. Now let's consider in a bit more detail. And let's remember this drawing again that I made here. You know, God, personal, infinite, and the two sides. If somebody's here who's never read any of my books, look on page 26 of Escape or 94 of The God Who Is There for this diagram. Oh, has anybody that hasn't a clue what I'm talking about? If there is, somebody pass them one of my books in a hurry, just so they can look at it, so I don't want to lose them. Put your name in it and pass it. Okay. Now let us notice that on the basis of this diagram, and I expect everybody here, therefore, to either be looking. Is there anybody who really doesn't know what I'm talking about? Please, don't be embarrassed. Nobody expects you to know. All right. There's some in the back. Who's got a book? Who has Escaped from Reason of the God Who Is There? Will you pass it back, please? Page 26 of Escape or 94 of the God Who Is There. Pass. Just, but please buy the books after you're done and don't just steal somebody else's. All right, now. Has everybody got the diagram now that never saw it before? All right, fine. Now let us notice with this diagram before us, on the side of God's infinity, God stands alone. He is absolutely the other. He is absolutely the other. He in his infinity, is contrary to all else. He in his infinity is contrary to all else. He is differentiated from all else. Now notice I'm only talking about on the side of his infinity. So if you've never studied my book, please take your hand in the diagram and cover up personal and all that is below it and only be looking at an infinity. Do you see where? Cover up personal and only be looking at infinity. He is differentiated from all else. He is the other. He is alone. On the side of his infinity, he is the creator and all else is the created. He is the infinite and all else is finite. All else he brought forth by creation, so all else is dependent and he alone is independent. And every one of these words just rings like great, great, tremendous sounds of symbols if you understand the discussion in the 20th century. Therefore, on the side of God's infinity, man is as separated from God as the atom, A-T-O-M, or any machine portion of the universe is separated from God. But on the side of God, as a personal God, man is made in God's image, and as such, we have the answer to man being finite and yet being personal, in contrast to finite non-man. It is not that that this is the best answer to the problem of the question we're dealing with at this point. I would insist it is the only answer that has ever been verbalized that fits the need. I really would be perfectly willing to debate this anywhere, really, providing it was possible and providing it seemed to be people wanted to discuss and not just to win small points on the debating team. It is not that this is the best answer, it is the only answer in the area of metaphysics at this point. The only answer to what exists is that he is infinite. He is the infinite, sorry, definite article. He is the infinite personal God. He really is there. Now, he is not an Aristotelian abstract. Aristotle is no better than Plato. So I'm not saying for a moment that the great unmoved mover, the great abstraction, gives you an answer for anything. That is not the point. The point is, however, that if the infinite personal God is there, point one, that he has the content of what the Bible says, and two, that he exists, then you have no more problem in the area of existence, as it now is. Point two. Point one is in parenthesis, as I've used it here, and all of it is on the side of the infinite personal God. Point two, the personal unity and diversity on the high order of Trinity. Point two, the personal unity and diversity on the high order of Trinity. Einstein is the best man to look at here. Einstein reduced all the material world to electromagnetism and gravity. At the end of his life, he was seeking for a unity between electromagnetism and gravity, and he never could find an answer, and no one has a clue as to what it might be since. But nevertheless, but if he had found a unity in diversity, a factor, what shall I call it now, Q, which it would include both electromagnetism and gravity, let us notice that it would only have been child's play still, for it would not have touched in any way the needed personal unity and diversity. Personal, whole idea of personality is still left out cold at this point. It doesn't mean that we mustn't say thank you to Einstein for teaching us a lot, many, many things. But what I'm saying is even that Einstein wasn't able to get a unity and diversity in the material world, but even if he had on something on Q higher than above electromagnetism and gravity, it's still been child's play. I know you're getting tired, but maybe it's worth 1 minute, and I'm going to put an appendix in the back of the book. He is there and he's not silent, if I can. And this will be those of you who've worked with me in Waymo and on the tapes. Naturalistic science is poor science, but I hope I can do it better than I've ever done it on tape. And that is, you remember, I discussed in the area of science the same thing. And that is that you have particulars, and then you have, sorry, I better go lower. You have particulars in the area of science. You must understand, nobody thinks any different. Science, philosophy, it's all the same. It's only different symbol systems wrestling with the same basic things in a real world. So now you have a certain set of particulars, and then you make a law, you say, and includes them. And then you have something else, and you have another law. And then let's say Newton came along and said this, and then let's say you had Faraday over here, Maxwell, and you had electricity says this, something like this. Is electromagnetism, and this is Newton, and then you come along and Einstein says yes, but this isn't enough, because after all, now this design, I'm messing myself up, but forgive me, on this electromagnetism will be slightly different. It doesn't matter though. I'm not teaching science enough. We can do that tomorrow night or some other time. Now when you come along here, therefore, so you come above Newton. And what you have then, and you say, all right, we'll include everything here like this. Now, my diagram's not right scientifically, so I'm not, forgive me for that. But it isn't worth another 20 minutes. Here. So what you have is, therefore, that suddenly a law, here you have a law, and then somebody like, something comes along, such as Einstein, and he says, we'll include all this under one heading. I'll just rub out all this nomenclature. And then we're safe. It embarrasses me to have something wrong on the board. I got a pain from it, you know. So it's one like this. So I'll say this is A. It's much better now. And this is B. And this is C. And then this is D. You see what I've done? And then Einstein comes along and says, all right, gravity. So I'll change this to G. And then he says electromagnetism. Like this, you see. So now you have two super laws.
And these are two super laws binding together millions and billions of particulates, as we shall discuss later in the area oranges and apples and fruits, when we're discussing what in the world we're talking about unity and diversity in the area of epistemology. And then the next thing comes, the problem, you see, is Einstein, what he would have liked to have done is this. And then he would have had a perfect answer on the basis of material universe, but he never was able to achieve it. But what I'm saying is, even if you say, okay, gravity and electromagnetism, it's still child's play, because the only way you can say this includes everything is to say that personality does not exist. Please go back and notice in my notes my arguments about behaviorism. It would fit, and determinism would fit at this particular place. Incidentally, Einstein is amazing because at the end of his life, he became a mystic because he understood very, very well the arguments I'm making tonight, but in the area of science. He did not return to Judaism, so he had no answers. But he died in Princeton as a mystic in the modern sense of mysticism because on the basis of his science, the common uniformity of natural causes in the closed system did not go. Very intriguing factor. Okay, let's go on. I just did this passing so you would understand. So what I said now is that you'd only have child's play if you did have a total unity and diversity in the area of only material or mass or energy or motion. But on the other hand, let's consider the Nicene Creed. Mass, motion, and energy. What I've just covered. Now you come to this particular point. What does the Nicene Creed say? The Nicene Creed says there are three persons loving each other and in communication before everything else was. Now you must understand these men were brilliant, brilliant men, and I thank God literally every time I wrestle with problems of the Trinity with modern men, including modern theologians, that they were so wide as to use the word person at the point of the three persons of the Trinity. That's really beautiful. Every once in a while people will say, well, you use this word personal so much about God. The Bible or the creeds don't use it. And I always insist that isn't true. God's a living God. He's the rewarder of them, the diligent seekers, et cetera, et cetera. I could exegete, I think, for hours on the fact that he really is a personal God. Or, on the other hand, creedally, you must understand that they put the word person at a better place than my word personal in one sense. I use the word personal for just as a word, considering personal infinite. But they say the three persons of the Trinity were there. So that's a better statement, but it doesn't go quite right for the 20th century mind until you arrive at some point like this. That's the only reason I do the other. I think what they've done is better. In finality, but it doesn't end so well. It isn't as good an open place for discussion, maybe. And that is, they see, therefore, that there were three persons. But who are these three persons? They were loving each other and in communication before all else was. Before all else was. And if this is not so, let's notice, if God was not there in three persons communicating and in if God was not there in a way of unity and diversity so that, indeed, there could be communication and love before the creation of everything else, if he was not there in such a way, you must understand you're left with a God who needed to create in order to love if he was going to love, and to communicate if there was going to be communication unless he only talked to himself. And that will not go exegetically from Scripture. When the Bible says, when Jesus prays in John 17 and says, the love wherein you have loved me before the creation of the world, he was not talking to himself. It's very important exegetically here. The same thing, it's the whole argument of many other things you can bring in, of these tremendous communications which the Bible insists that the Father had with his Son prior to the creation of the world. I don't like Blake's philosophy or his theology by any means. He was following what's his name for a lot of his life, doesn't matter. But a lot of his pictures are great, if you understand them from a biblical viewpoint. These beautiful pictures of Blake before the creation of all else, the Father and the Son communicating together. Something very beautiful in Blake, as long as you don't accept Blake's philosophy or his religion. But I'll see it as, but carry it over into your own thought forms of Christianity. The Bible makes very plain that God the Father loved the Son before the creation of the world, and the Bible makes very, very plain that the Father and the Son had communication before the creation of the world as well, and the Holy Spirit is not left out, though not as clearly delineated at this particular place. If this is not the case, if there was not communication and there was not love before the creation of all else, then what you have to understand is that God would then need the universe as much as the universe needed him. And be careful of this one at every, again, in discussion. I've had it, I don't know, a million times in my lifetime, I guess. And often by people who really should know better and are yet are being honest. And by other people who are simply being very naughty and hoping I don't know the answer. But in either case, it is put forward as something like this. And beware. And that is, does God love? And you say, yes. And then they say, then he needs something to love. And you say, yes. And then they say, then God had to create the universe to have something, an object to love. And this being the case, therefore, God is as much dependent upon the universe as the universe is dependent upon God. Well, you're stuck unless you have a true ontological trinity. But hurry up and quote the Nicene Creed, and you'll have no more problem if a man is an honest man and an intelligent one. But with its full and true trinity, this is not so. Not only do you have an answer to the acute philosophic need of unity and diversity, but a personal unity and diversity. The unity and diversity cannot be back of God, because what is the furthest thing back is always God. Notice, please, write this one down too. The unity and diversity cannot be back of God, for whatever is furthest back is God. Remember my discussion of the Greek faith. Nobody knows whether the faiths are back of the gods or the gods back of the faith. Whatever is the furthest thing back, in other words, whatever is the final realities and everything, you know, the last move on the board, it's God. It doesn't matter what words you use for it, including energy particles. But in the biblical teaching, the unity and diversity is God himself as he is in Trinity. It is not back of God. But you must then explain the Trinity with the full orthodox, uncompromised, ontological Trinity, which can be expressed at 1 equals 3. If somebody wants to discuss on the reasonableness of this, discuss it with some of our men another time. It is discussable, too, incidentally, in a very real way. But nevertheless, having said this, you must see that this is the answer that is needed, and this is exactly what the Bible says, and this is what the Nicene Creed insisted on. That you have three persons equals one God. And our forefathers understood well at 325 that when they stressed the three persons, the word persons in the Trinity, as the Bible had clearly set it forth. Now notice I want to take about 2 minutes in another parenthesis that's valuable. We're getting on here. And that is this. And that is that they did not invent the Trinity in order to answer the Greek problem. You must see that this is the answer that is needed, and this is exactly what the Bible says, and this is what the Nicene Creed insisted on. That you have three persons equals one God. And our forefathers understood well at 325 that when they stressed the three persons, the word persons in the Trinity, as the Bible had clearly set it forth. Now notice I want to take about 2 minutes in another parenthesis that's valuable. We're getting on here. And that is that they did not invent the Trinity in order to answer the Greek problem. Now this is what Jim Pike said they did, but it just isn't true. Would somebody pass me up a chair? I'm starting to get wobbly. There's one right here. Thank you very much. Tell me about this mic now. But this is exactly, I'll get up and down, but I've got to sit here once.
But this is exactly what Jim Pike says occurred, or said, and that is that Pike said that the Trinity was only an outmoded, thank you, is only an outmoded Greek concept, and therefore could be thrown aside because the concept of the ontologic Trinity was derived from Greek philosophic thought, which was limited to the 4th and 5th century or something like this, and now is understood to be nonsense. But he's wrong, and I'm sure if Pike was here tonight, he would agree that I was right in this. I never presented this to him in our talks together. Incidentally, I'm sorry for Jim Pike, because he promised me to come to La Brie, and the next time he went to the Holy Land, of course, he never got home. But I really feel sorry, because Pike, I don't know how honest he was, but he certainly tried at certain points. And more than this, maybe another parenthesis would be well placed at this particular time, and that is, I'll never forget the last words that Jim Pike said to me, and that was to Edith and myself when we were with him in Santa Barbara, just before he left, from the last time we saw him, and that was, he said, you know, Francis and Edith, he said, when I went to Union Theological Seminary, I was really looking for something.